Good morning to you. It's good to be with you even on a cold day. I'm grateful for the comfort that we have in which we can worship. I'm going to talk a little bit about that later, and so I hope you'll stick with me as we go through the lesson this morning. If you would, open your Bible to the book of John again for at least the second time this morning. We'll be there in just a moment. In our class on Wednesday nights, we're studying the letter of 1 John. And one of the points I've tried to make in that class is that clearly John intends for his readers to read his letter, 1 John, in light of his gospel. So we've looked at some connections between John's letter and his gospel as time has permitted. But this morning, I want to look at one of the passages from the Gospel of John that came up in our study this past Wednesday night. And I want to look at it a little more closely. Because in the time since our class, I've been thinking about it a lot, and it's challenged me on a deeply personal level. I hope it's going to challenge you in a similar way as well. So I hope you brought your steel-toed shoes this morning. I guess I didn't either, so this could be interesting. But it was very challenging to think about, and I hope that it will help us be more like Jesus. So if you have a Bible, join me in John chapter 9. John chapter 9. And we'll begin reading at the beginning of that chapter. John 9 and verse 1. As he, that is Jesus, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. In theory, you know, that should have been all there was to this story. This is a 41-verse chapter, so obviously that's not all there was to this story. But those 7 verses really should have been all there was to it. Jesus saw a man who was blind from birth. He explains that his condition is actually for God's glory. It's not a matter of sin. And clarifies some questions, and then he proceeds to begin healing the man. He gives him instructions to go wash, after which the man comes back seeing. And God is glorified, as intended. Great. Mission accomplished. Well, not quite, because that's not all that actually happened. The rest of John chapter 9 is all about what continues to transpire with this formerly blind man to whom Jesus had given the gift of sight. And the story is so long because guess who gets involved? As per usual, the good old Pharisees. They're always at the ready to spoil anything good that's going on in the gospel. So here they are again. Verse 13 says, they brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. First mistake, of course. And obviously the Pharisees have all kinds of problems with Jesus already in John's gospel. We've seen this. They're not going to let this go. They're not going to let this incident just slip by and say, well, that's fine. Notice verse 16 of John chapter 9. Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was a division among them. Interesting. In verse 16, many of the Pharisees declare their abject rejection of Jesus as the Messiah. And then in justifying this declaration that they reject him, they reveal one of their primary complaints about him. He doesn't keep the Sabbath. Well, at least he doesn't keep it like they would like him to keep it. As it turns out, verse 14 reveals that this whole healing the blind man episode took place on the Sabbath day. Verse 14 specifically says, "Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes." However, when these other Pharisees, in verse 16, it says, "But others said," so when these other Pharisees bring up the fact that his signs and miracles are undeniable, notice how they rephrase what the previously referenced Pharisees have been saying. So the first Pharisees, this is in verse 16. The first Pharisees say, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." And the others then say, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? What does that tell us? Well, it tells us what the Pharisees really think about Jesus. They kind of interpret it for us. It tells us those first Pharisees have essentially declared Jesus to be a sinner. That's what they think about him. They're calling him a sinner by accusing him of doing something they do not seem to believe they have ever been guilty of. That is, failing to keep the Sabbath. And if that's not already clear to us, maybe there's some implication that we have to draw there, but they make that even clearer when they interview the man who is healed for a second time. They call him back and say, wait, 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 tell us this again. We're just not real sure about this. So verse 24, they do that. So for the second time, they called the man who had been blind and said to him, give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner. And so clearly that's what they think about Jesus. But let's keep reading there. He, the blind man, answered, or the formerly blind man, I should say, answered, whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. They said to him, what did he do to you? Are you kidding me? He just told them that. And they say, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered them, I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? And they reviled him, saying, you are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. Okay. Wow, there's a lot there. Those Pharisees are clearly very interested in this man's answers because they keep asking him, but he keeps telling them the plain truth, exactly as it has happened to him, and still they are not satisfied. And I think that's intentional that John records all of that for us. I think it's intentional because it makes you wonder, are they looking for something else here besides the truth of just what happened? And I think the Pharisees reveal by their handling of this situation that that is absolutely the case. They are not just interested in the truth. They are looking for the answer they want to hear. That's what they're after here. They want him to cave to their pressure of being put out of the synagogue, all the social pressures that were in place for the Jews at that point. They want him to cave and just say what they want to hear. They are looking for a reason not to accept Jesus. They're not looking for the truth. They're looking for a reason not to believe in Jesus. And we'll talk more about that in a few moments. But as the narrative proceeds, the Pharisees cast out the blind man. They do. They kick him out of the synagogue, and Jesus finds him and speaks to him. So let's pick up when that happens in verse 35 of John 9. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, and who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Jesus said to him, you have seen him. And it is he who is speaking to you. He said, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, are we also blind? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains. There's a lot going on here in this chapter. But the big picture of what is happening is Jesus is challenging their notion and our notion of who is really blind. And so I want to talk with you this morning about Jesus and the blind. There is so much more to this story than even meets the eye, no pun intended. And if you're anything like me, you'll find it to be a thought-provoking and personally challenging account. There's a lot we could say about this account, but I want to keep my observations to 3 points, you know, the biblical 3 points for a sermon, about Jesus' relationship with the blind in this text. And then I want to challenge all of us with a couple of applications as we wrap this all up. So the first observation I want to point out to you about this is that Jesus intentionally did things that would allow people to see he was the Son of God. And we see that because even some of the Pharisees who saw this miracle seem to be starting to pick up on this. I mean, you have the Pharisees who didn't believe and said, no, 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 he's a sinner. There is no way around this. But then you also have the other Pharisees who push back on that and say, this man can't be a sinner if he can do things like what he just did, like what we know he did. This guy was blind and now he sees. I don't think we can just toss him out the window as a sinner. They're almost saying like, guys, wait up. There's something else going on here. I don't know for sure what it is, but we can't just discount him as a sinner because look what he did. We can't ignore that. And so in pushing back the way they do, they're basically opening the door to the possibility that Jesus' claims of deity may be legitimate. He didn't make those claims in this text, but he certainly did as recently as at the end of the previous chapter in John chapter 8, in verses 54 and 55, where Jesus said to the Jews, Jesus answered, "If I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say he is our God. But you have not known him. I know him. If I were to say that I do not know him, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him, and I keep his word." And then he gets even more direct in verse 58 of John chapter 8, when Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." And that's when they start picking up the stones. All right, get this guy, kill him. They really do. They pick up stones to kill him. It seems fairly certain that they had heard these claims. Surely they knew of what Jesus was saying and spreading around when he's going around saying, "I am." I mean, they know what's going on here, or at least they'd heard about this. And so by saying what they said in chapter 9 and verse 16, where they're divided, they are admitting that they are able to see something deeper may be going on here. So clearly, Jesus isn't trying to hide this. I mean, he said it openly in chapter 8, and he's doing this miracle that's supposed to show them exactly who he is. He's trying to let people see. He's not hiding this fact. And even the Pharisees can see that. But then perhaps the most amazing example of this is that the man who was born blind could see that this was the Son of God. It's not just that he could have sight now, but he saw that Jesus was God. And that's what we see in their interaction, verses 35 through 38 there, where Jesus asks him, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He says, "Well, who is he?" And Jesus says, again, I just get chills, "You have seen him. You have seen him." And then he said, "Lord, I believe." That's incredible. And clearly, Jesus' goal was to let people see this, perhaps literally here, that he's the Son of God, but even in a deeper sense than that. But just imagine what it would be like if you were this guy, if you were the blind man from birth. You've never seen anything in your life. That's what blind from birth. Imagine growing up in a world, you have come to adulthood, you've never seen anything, and then this man miraculously heals you. And of course, because of that, you pick up on the fact that he's probably not your average guy. He's probably somebody special, maybe a prophet, maybe a teacher from God of some kind, not entirely sure, but you know he's different. And then that man asks you if you believe in the Son of Man, which was the Son of God. And then you say, "Well, I want to, but who is he? Like, I want to believe in him. I'm open to that." And then he says, "You have seen him. He's the one talking to you right now." Imagine just what's going on in his head right at that moment. This man couldn't see a thing from birth until now, and yet the moment Jesus identifies himself and tells the man, "You have seen the Son of Man," the man simply and immediately says, "Lord, I believe." Essentially saying, "Yes, Lord, I have seen the Son of Man. Though I was blind, now I see, but I don't just see what's around me. I see Jesus as the Son of God." So not only does this man now have physical sight, but he has sight in the sense that he has understanding. As we talk about, "Oh, I see that." Mike's trying to explain to us about Ezra chapter 4 and how this is kind of like an insert of like a bigger timeline. And I might say, "Do you see that?" And I say, "Oh, I do see that." Is he saying, "Do you literally lay eyes on it?" No, he's saying, do you get it? Do you understand it? Have you processed it? And that's exactly what this man has. Yes, he has physical sight, but now he's seeing Jesus for who he really is. He has seen the Son of God, and he has seen that Jesus is the Son of God. So that's really amazing. It's a beautiful picture. But you know what's even more beautiful? Jesus has allowed us to do the very same thing. Jesus did these things that would allow, you can sub people for us. that would allow us to see that he was and is the Son of God. And that isn't by accident. Why was the Gospel of John written? John 20, verse 31, so that you may believe. I would argue that very much applies to us. Even though it was not written to us, it was certainly written for us. Jesus came into the world to be the light of the world. Chapter 9 and verse 5, I am the light of the world, he says. And he came into the world so that all could see him. That's what you do with light. All people could see him and see that he was from God. This truth was designed to be plain to everybody, to all people. Jesus didn't come into the world in a shadowy place and hide out in like a back alley. He didn't scurry into a house to avoid the crowds. I mean, he certainly withdrew to pray to his Father, but he came into the world as the true light. The light of the world. Not the light of this one section or this little light under a bushel. No, he came into the world as the light of the entire world. So when it comes to Jesus and the blind, the first thing that becomes apparent by the stunningly miraculous work that he does to begin this chapter is that Jesus' intent was not to keep people blind to his identity. He was doing everything he could to allow everyone to see he is the Son of God. He is the Messiah that they've been waiting for. But unfortunately, not everyone was willing to see this truth about Jesus. And as he made it clear to everyone who was willing to see, Jesus' miracle revealed who was truly blind. And spoiler alert, it wasn't the blind man. We start out this narrative being introduced to that guy, to an actual blind man. Everybody knew he was blind. They all were like, are we sure this is the guy? Because we know he was blind from birth. And yet by the end of the story, no one would have said he was blind in any way. He had been healed and he had seen Jesus. But that physical reality that he had gotten his sight, he'd laid eyes on Jesus, that physical reality is meant to point us to a greater spiritual reality. For those of us on the outside looking in, looking back at this, the fact that the man is clearly not physically blind anymore by the end of the story is supposed to point us to the fact that he is not spiritually blind either. He has gained not only his physical sight, but his spiritual sight. He has been enlightened. Jesus says, do you believe in the Son of Man? He's like, I would, but I am he. You've seen him. You're talking to him. I believe. He sees. In fact, there is a sense in which he was never spiritually blind to begin with. He just didn't know Jesus because being blind, he had not seen Jesus. And we have no indication he knew of Jesus' identity at all. He only had an interaction with Jesus in the first place because Jesus passed by him and Jesus' disciples asked him a question about the blind man. He said, oh, this guy, who sinned in this case? But when Jesus came to him and he offered to heal him, yet he told him very specific instructions. He told him, go wash in this very specific pool in order for his healing to be complete. What did the man do? He didn't do what the Pharisees did. He immediately obeyed Jesus. He just went. He just went. So even early on in this account, we find that this man, maybe he can't see out of his eyes, but he's not blind, metaphorically speaking. He's not blind to the fact that he is blind. Nor is he blind to the possibility that Jesus has legitimate power to heal him. And his obedience shows us this fact. He knows he has a problem. But even more so, when presented with the truth about Jesus, he saw Jesus for who he really was immediately. And his acceptance of that truth was immediate. He might have been physically blind at one point, but he was never completely spiritually blind. The Pharisees, on the other hand, notice one of their continuous characteristics in the Gospels is they are really observant. I mean, they'd have to be so picky. Wait a minute, he didn't keep the Sabbath. Wait a minute, did he wash his hands? Wait a minute. See all the things they're seeing, they're noticing about Jesus? They are so observant. They've seen everything Jesus does. They're watching like hawks. They've been asking questions. They've been closely evaluating everything he's doing. Even they've been making spiritual judgments about it based on what they have seen and observed. It seems pretty clear. They're not blind. They see Jesus. They're very observant. But notice, as they question the man who was, in theory, blind from birth, it becomes clear they are actually the ones who are blind. They are blind to the truth about Jesus. We see that because they're not looking for the truth in their questioning of this guy. No, they're looking for confirmation of what they already believe. That's all they're interested in. They're looking for confirmation that they were righteous and Jesus was a sinner, as they imply in what they say to the blind man after they have asked him to tell them again what Jesus did to him. Notice verses 26 through 28 here in John chapter 9, beginning verse 26. They said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" And they just wouldn't have that. They reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses." They say, yeah, you might be his disciple. You might think you need him, but we're disciples of Moses. In other words, you might need some miracle-working sinner to follow or to grasp onto to give you some kind of hope, but we are good. We have Moses, so don't worry about us. We're good. It's a similar statement to the one the Jews make in the previous chapter of John's gospel when they call on another father of Israel, in a sense, when they say in chapter 8 and verse 39, "Abraham is our father." And so they're calling on all these figures and saying, "We're good. We got Abraham. We got Moses. We don't need Jesus," basically. And the fact is, the truth that they did need him was literally staring them right in the face in the form of a blind man who for the first time in his life was able to see because of Jesus' divine power that he's demonstrating, which he could only have if he was truly from God, which some of the Pharisees even start to pick up on. But they were blind to this truth. They just couldn't accept it. And why were they blind to this truth? Why? Because they're good. They're fine. They've got Moses. They've got Abraham. They don't need some new miracle-working prophet to do anything for them. They're in good shape spiritually. No problem with them. Ultimately, I would suggest to you that the Pharisees were blind to the truth about Jesus because they were blind to their need for him. Now, the opposite was true for the blind man, He shows us that those who are not blind to their need, even if they are literally physically blind, but are not blind to their need and are willing to come to Jesus and obey Jesus, they will be healed. And they will be able to see Jesus. They will truly see. That man knew he had a problem. He knew he had a need for someone to help him with it. And so when Jesus came along, Jesus began to heal him and told him, "Okay, go do something as part of his healing." He jumped at the chance and he immediately obeyed Jesus. And he was healed. He was healed. And the beautiful thing is that the same is true for us. Whenever we are not blind to our problem, namely our sin, and Jesus comes to us, which Jesus has come to us. He's come in the flesh. He's come into our world. And if we see our problem to the extent that we are willing to trust him and obey him, believing that he has the power to heal us, we can take heart that just like the blind man, we will be healed. We, like the blind man, we'll be able to see Jesus. That's what we should all be striving for. Seeing Jesus in the sense that our eyes can be opened to the truth about him and we can experience a relationship with God through his Son that can set our lives right. That is seeing Jesus in a sense. But there is an even greater sense in which we hope to see Jesus. We can also trust that one day we will be able to see Jesus in his fullness. That's the hope of every Christian. And if we are not blind to our need for Jesus, and if we are willing to obey him by being washed in the waters of baptism and dying with him there, notice the connection between the pool of Siloam. That's exactly what he asked him to do. Go wash, right? It wasn't some rite to say, well, there's magic in that water. No, Jesus had the power. He said, obey me. This is going to require obedience, this submission to me. That's what that is. It's going to require a life of doing that. And so if we're willing to do that, in baptism and die with Jesus, submit to him, we can be healed too. Both in a very real sense right now, we can be healed. But one day we can be healed in an eternal sense, in a perfect sense. This narrative shows us that those who are not blind to their need for Jesus, who know they need Jesus and are willing to obey him, can be healed and will be able to see him. But on the flip side, this account also shows us that those who think they see, we're good, we're fine, we don't need to see anything else. We can see very clearly that he's a sinner and we're good. Those people who are unwilling to acknowledge their need, those are the real blind people. And that really is the great irony of this story. The Pharisees seem to have no problems with their eyesight as the story begins. They're watching everything real closely that Jesus does and picking out all kinds of problems with it. But as the story ends, it becomes clear that they are more blind than the blind man ever was. And Jesus makes that point as the chapter concludes in verses 39 through 41. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see," quote, "see, may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, "Are we also blind?" Jesus, yeah, definitely in that voice. But Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, 'We see,' your guilt remains." Where do they say, "We see"? Well, their question. Jesus knew exactly what they meant by that. And in fact, in most of our English translations, the Pharisees' question in verse 40 reads, "Are we also blind?" But looking at the original language, a more accurate rendering of their question would be, "We are not blind too, are we?" Surely not. And so Jesus picks up on that and he says, "You say we see, and that's exactly why you are guilty. That's why your guilt remains. It could go away. Yeah, you have guilt, but it could go away if you would just see that you have it. I'm trying to show you that. I'm the light. I'm trying to expose that." And yet they are unwilling to see it. It's just almost laughable that they ask it this way because they clearly expected a negative answer. No. You're the Pharisees. You're good. But even after Jesus' fairly direct and clear indictment of their blindness, their question is, but we're not the blind ones, right? Of course, the point is that they are. And that those who are so confident that they don't need Jesus are the blindest of all and need him most desperately. So those are the three big observations I wanted us to consider together this morning about this narrative of the blind man who is healed by Jesus. But in trying to think more deeply about this episode, here are a couple points of application for us to all think about. First of all, the world is filled with this kind of people. People who are blind to their need for Jesus. I was talking to someone recently who I know. I grew up with them in Alabama, but she actually is from Springfield, Illinois. And so she's kept up with the work that Ken and Penny McDaniel are doing in that place, along with others, trying to spread the gospel. But she told me as she's visited and kept up with that, she said, "It just breaks my heart that they haven't had more success in reaching people there." And I started to say, "Well, you know, that takes time," and kind of encourage her. Well, maybe it's not all for naught. But then she got a little more personal. And she said, "You know, I have sisters there. I grew up there. But my sisters are not Christians. One's Catholic. One doesn't go anywhere. But they've come to church with me when I visited up there. But they're just not that interested." And here's why she said that's the case. She said, "They're not interested because they just don't see their need for it. They don't see their need to be closer to Jesus." And how many people does that describe that we know, that we interact with on a weekly basis, maybe even on a daily basis? They just don't see their need for the Lord. They're nice people. They're happy to interact with us. They're good neighbors. But they just don't see their need for the Lord. Somehow they've tricked themselves into thinking that their lives are good the way they are, that they're better off without being a disciple of Jesus. They've got all they need. They've got a decent bank account, decent retirement, insurance policies, families to take care of them. They're doing okay. They've got jobs to keep the money coming in. They've got homes to live in. They've got a vehicle to drive, food to eat. They're okay. They don't need Jesus in their mind. And our country, maybe Western countries in general, are filled with people like that. I mean, absolutely filled. There are third world countries out there where people are more willing to respond to the gospel because they know their lives are terrible. They know they're in need. They recognize they have a need for something better. But in our attempt to spread the gospel at home, part of what we're trying to do is help people see their need for Jesus. We're trying to help people wake up and see that their lives are actually quite sad and hopeless without a relationship with Jesus. And to be honest, people know that. if they would really think about their lives aren't that great. Everybody has family dysfunction. Everybody has problems. Everybody has suffering. And so our task is to try and help them see that that's supposed to point you to Jesus. That's on purpose. It's not just to make you miserable. But in this country and in many others, it's very hard to get people to recognize that they have a need to draw nearer to Jesus. And that really is one of our biggest challenges as we try to spread the gospel. But speaking of people who live in this country and their challenges, I have a question that I think is even more critically important than the sad reality that so many around us are blind to their need for Jesus. That critical question is it possible that we also might be blind to our need for Jesus? Could we be the blind ones? Could we be the Pharisees who say, we're in the church building, we're reading the Bible, we even went to class, I mean, we showed up an hour early, we're really spiritual, we see, I mean, we've got it, right? We're doing the true thing, worshiping in spirit and truth, doing all the things right that we learned as kids. Is it possible that we're a little more like the Pharisees sometimes than we care to admit? Just because we're in a church building this morning doesn't mean that we're not blind to our need for Jesus. And sometimes that is true in the sense of the physical gifts that God gives to us. Sometimes we don't see just how dependent we are on God for everything that we have physically. I've run into this recently in my own life. And a lot of this is prompted by things that I've been struggling with and working through. As we prepare to go full-time with the Enlight work, been having to do some fundraising. And it hasn't been as quick as I thought it would be. And our income's going to be dependent on that fundraising. And so this is really scary, I'll be honest with you. I believe it's an important work that needs to be done in the kingdom, and so we're jumping out in faith, but that's scary. And I don't know if I'm going to have any income for the latter two-thirds of the year right now. So we're still in that process. But I think it has pointed me back to the reality that I thought things were so certain. I thought everything is just fine because I have all this income that comes in from these churches every month. Check, no problem. I do the work. I prepare the lessons. I try to teach and everything. And in comes the paycheck. That's how it works. And this made me realize, no, it's not that now I'm dependent on God and I need to develop faith. It's that I was always dependent on God. And sometimes we lose that because we're so used to, I go to work, I get a paycheck, and that's all there is to it. Not realizing that we were always dependent on God. And sometimes those kind of situations in our life where things are turned upside down can help us see that. And so we see the blessings even in that. But even beyond just seeing it in physical ways, sometimes it's true that we are blind to our need for God in a spiritual sense. This can happen when, maybe like the Pharisees, we feel really strong spiritually. And maybe we start out, we are actually very strong spiritually. But then we start comparing ourselves to others who are not as strong. And we can sometimes get into a place where we start to feel like we've got it all right. Everything's in order. We have ordered things just as they ought to be, and others have not. Others have it all wrong. That's not to say that it's not important to study and find the truth. We must be concerned with the truth. That's a major theme of John's gospel. But it's in how we do it. When our quest for truth is carried out in such a way that the goal is not to draw nearer to Jesus, but just to get it right so I feel good, that's when pride has creeped in. That's when it's about us. It's not about him. And our pride is actually blinding us to the fact that we are trapped in the sin of pride. And so you get this vicious cycle going on that can keep us blind because we can't acknowledge our need. It's humbling to acknowledge our need. It's like me jumping out and saying, I need someone to help me financially. I don't have money of my own to finance this kingdom work. And the same is true of us spiritually. But if we're blind to that, then we are truly the blind ones. And I've been there, maybe you have too. And sometimes our blindness to our physical need for God can cause blindness to our spiritual need for God. I mean, looking at us in this room, we are not the richest people in this country. We're not. But we are still so comfortable. And we are so used to the feeling of never being in need physically, most of us, that we fail to see, I think, sometimes when we are in need spiritually. We don't even recognize that fact. But the reality is that we depend on God for everything. We depend on God for life and for breath and for everything. That's what Paul says in Acts chapter 17. It's one of my favorite passages in the entire Bible. Acts 17, 24 and 25. Paul says, "The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything." We're completely dependent on him. Are we blind to our need for Jesus? Sobering question for us all to think about. The Pharisees thought that they knew that God was the source of everything. They would have said, yeah, absolutely, amen to that, right? And yet they were blind to that reality. They didn't really see it. They saw it in the text, but they didn't understand it. The blind man, on the other hand, knew he had a problem. He knew he needed healing. And when Jesus came to him, he obeyed. And he said, "Lord, I believe." So we've seen two very different scenarios this morning. One group of people who thought they saw so clearly, and yet they were totally blind to their greatest need. And then on the other hand, we've seen a man who knew he couldn't see a thing and was actually the one who, by the end of the narrative, was the only one there who saw Jesus for who he really was. One group who said, "We're not blind too, are we?" No, right? Just say no. And then on the other hand, a man who said, "Once I was blind, but now I see because of Jesus." And later he said, "Lord, I believe." May we always see our need for Jesus. May we never be blind to our failures, but may we come to the light of Christ, that they may be revealed, and we may find the healing and true sight that we need, whether we recognize it or not, in him. May we recognize our need for him. May we see it. May we come to him and let him show us how we need to be more like him. If you have a spiritual need this morning, if you're in need in a way and you realize that now, formerly blind to it maybe, we'd love to help you with that if we can. But either way, I'd encourage you to be thinking about that this week. But if you have something we can help you with now, come forward as we stand and sing.